such as a, quote, radio. It's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR.
Saturday at 10 a.m. and Sunday at noon on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We'd like to begin today's program by talking about immigration. This week, the Obama administration announced plans to allow the spouses of some highly skilled temporary immigrants to work in the United States. The administration hopes this change will help keep the best and brightest technology workers and scientists in this country. But there are critics on both sides. Some say the proposal is too narrow. Others say the promise leaves fewer jobs for Americans. We wanted to hear more about what this change could mean. So we've called upon Laura Murray Chan. She is an immigration lawyer and professor at Boston College Law School. She joins us from Boston. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
Also joining us is Vinny Lingham. He is co-founder and CEO of Gift.com. He's an immigrant from South Africa. He's advocated for immigration and visa reform, and he's with us from Stanford, California. Mr. Lingham, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So Laura Murray Chan, let me start with you, Professor. This proposal affects workers on something called H-1Bs, and that could be hundreds of thousands of people, but it doesn't affect all of them. Am I right?
That's correct. It actually affects a narrow group of them. So H-1Bs, like you said, they're specialty occupation workers, primarily in the STEM fields, so science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And this affects the spouses of those workers who are already on a path to obtaining permanent residency.
So these aren't just people who are just here working and who expect to stay here. For the H-1Bs are generally, what, 6 years? They are visas for 6 years. So people during that time who've applied for permanent residency, a green card, they are the people who can apply. Is that correct?
Exactly. And their employers have to have sponsored them for those green cards. So it's not a unilateral decision on their part.
Okay, go ahead. Vinny, I want to hear from you as well. But what does this allow? What change will this make? Is this a big change? Since it doesn't affect all of these workers, it only affects some. Is this still a significant change?
Look, I mean, every step forward is I think significant in the way we look at immigration reform. But it's a big change for people who have been living here, you know, for many years, paying their taxes, you know, productive members of society, and having spouses who are either not living with them in the United States and living back home because financially they can't afford to do that, or living locally but not being able to, you know, contribute to society effectively. And so therefore, you know, it puts pressure on the families because you've got and one working spouse. And, you know, I think it's just fair, right? Someone's been here for a couple of years, they're on path to permanent residency, and I personally think that the spouse should have probably been able to work from the beginning. I think if someone's coming across a highly skilled visa and, you know, what's the point of leaving the spouse at home, not being able to do anything? But fundamentally, we're moving in the right direction. I think more could be done, but, you know, there are challenges to that.
Laura, could you explain to us, Professor Murray Chan, could you explain to us, like, what is it, amplify the issue that that Mr. Lingham is talking about here? What is the problem that this is designed to address? And I also wanted to ask you, why do you think it's evoked kind of a strong reaction, particularly even on the Republican side, where a lot of people on the Republican side have traditionally been supporters of immigration that favors highly skilled workers? So talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Sure. Please do call me Laura instead of Professor. That does go down easier, believe it or not.
Okay.
Well, there are two problems. One of the problems is that the Republicans are afraid of executive overreach. They're afraid that Obama is experimenting with exercising executive discretion, giving work cards, for example, to the Deferred Childhood Arrivals, that program of June 2012. That was a first major step. Mm. Now he comes along, he's giving work authorization to the spouses of H-1B workers. That's the immigration and nationality law title for these people, the H-1B workers. So it makes them nervous that he's taking these steps towards unilaterally authorizing people to either remain or to work. And of course, they're worried about displacing American workers. And that has gotten spoken a lot about in the past few days by people like Senator Jeff Sessions and Senator Chuck Grassley. That's their stated concern in addition to the executive overreaching.
And have you as a lawyer addressed people who have been in this situation? Talk a little bit about that.
As a lawyer, I do not actually
No, I'm asking you. I'm asking you, like, what in the field? Like, is this one of those pressing concerns, or is this
a huge, huge issue? This is a gigantic issue.
Yeah, tell me why.
Well, the H-1B cap was reached within a week of the application period. There are so many more workers who want to obtain this visa than can, and there are tech companies clamoring for these workers. So it is viewed as an enormous problem, both by the immigration bar and by the tech companies themselves.
Mr. Lingam, what about that? I mean, do you view this as kind of a competitive issue that you are a permanent resident with a green card yourself? You're the CEO of a startup in Silicon Valley. Do you see this as part of a kind of a competitive advantage in trying to hire the best people offering this?
Well, I mean, so one of the problems startups have right now is that we really can't compete with the big guys. We're struggling. And the talent pool is big, but it's very tight. So hiring engineers, it's a challenge. So, you know, the only way for us to solve the problem typically is to look elsewhere for talent, because if you know, Google, Facebook, you know, they're sucking up the thousands of workers that are already here, we have to pull workers in from other places. Now, you can have two arguments to this. You could argue, well, we should be pulling them in from other parts of the United States. But the reality is as startups, we need to hire people who typically are coming out of grad school, studied for, computer science, etc. And there's just a limited number of graduates. I mean, the U.S. only has, 5% of the world's population. So if you look at the niches we all play in and certain areas of focus around highly skilled, there may only be, call it, I'm throwing out numbers here, but a couple of hundred people in a specific field related to machine learning, for example. So if they're all going to the Googles and Facebooks of the world, you could look elsewhere, right? So there's a mathematical need for us to look elsewhere, because we just don't have enough grads in the U.S. in certain fields. And, the Obama administration and many other political groups have been advocating for STEM, and there's just not enough sort of STEM, science, technology, education, mathematics graduates.
Can I ask you that, though, Mr. Lingam? Two questions I wanted to ask you briefly, if you can. That first, to address the argument that some of the Republicans have made, and presumably some Democrats would agree with this, that this really relieves pressure on the educational system to produce more American graduates.
Right, but we've actually misaligned the incentives, because what we do is we give universities in the U.S. gradings, and we tell them, well, you know what? You should accept more people from international countries and educate them here, because that'll give you higher rankings when we rank the schools. So guess what? We go in our universities, with partially funded by taxpayer money, to an extent, go and bring in people from around the world to create diversity in the classroom. But then these people can't work in our country, and we ship them back to the country of origin. That makes no sense to me at all.
Is it also that many of these spouses are also highly skilled themselves? Is that part of it?
I mean, typically you don't really get, huge disparity between people who are highly skilled and the spouses they choose. Sometimes you do, but sometimes they're not even in the same field. So, it doesn't mean that just because one person is a scientist, the other one is going to be a scientist. It just could be, a lawyer and an artist, or a scientist and an artist. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're in the same, industry or field. I think, when you look at the problem just purely from a quantitative perspective, I think we've got something like 500,000 H-1Bs, and of those, 100,000 have got applications in for green cards, permanent residency. So if, for example, all of them were granted the green cards and all their spouses were put on, given work permits, that's 100,000 extra workers into the market. Now, if you look at the sort of unemployment numbers, we're talking millions. I mean, this is a fraction of the number of workers that are out there right now. And quite frankly, I think given where their spouses probably work and the areas they're working in, there may be pockets where jobs are available and they could fill the need. But I think it's much better to have productive members of society than people being forced to sit at home.
Laura, can I ask you a question? We have in the time that we have left, is that does the administration have the capacity to process all of these applications? I mean, you mentioned earlier that there's already been the administration has already decided to administratively move forward with what it had hoped to do legislatively, which is to allow deferred action on children who were brought here as children by parents, even if the parents are themselves not here with proper authorization. So that's a huge number of people, is it not? So do they even have the capacity administratively to process this? Because part of this, part of the issue here is the backlog, right?
Well, there are no conditions attached to the spouse's employment authorization documents. So it's actually a fairly quick and easy process. You prove that you're in the process of applying for a green card and you file an application for work authorization, and it's actually quite simple. So I would anticipate that that would not grow into a substantial backlog.
So, and Laura, finally, what are these spouses doing now? If they can't work, what do they do?
They might be going to school. They might be staying at home with their children, because most of these spouses anecdotally are, in fact, wives. You do hear stories about depression, alienation, suicidality. It's a major problem. And it was interesting, one of Vinny's first comments was that this seems fair. It really is a humanitarian issue. It's almost cruel to the spouses of the skilled workers to have to remain home and end their careers when they could be productive members of our society, like Vinny said, raising children while working, being role models for their children in terms of women in the workplace, and instead they're being forced to languish and sacrifice their own talents. So like he said, I think it's only fair. You know, of course, the president could have gone further and granted work authorization to all of these spouses, but he would have faced much more blowback from the opponents to this policy.
So even the temporary workers, you're saying that some advocates would like even the temporary workers to have had the right to have their spouses work. And briefly, we don't have that much time, but do you have any sympathy for the other side of the argument that people say, well, this reduces pressure on American universities to train more STEM graduates?
I have never heard that argument. I've heard what Vinny said, that we actually fear a brain drain as our highly skilled graduates are leaving this country because they can't get visas. And yes, Obama could have given visas to all of the H-4s.
Laura Marie Chan is an immigration lawyer and professor at Boston College Law School. Vinny Lingham is co-founder and CEO of Gift.com. Thanks to you both for joining us. We appreciate it. Coming up, there are so many options available to expectant mothers these days, yet many are seeking out an ancient practice.
I think women are looking for the intimacy. I always make the joke that midwives hug their patients.
We ask two midwives who work on different continents about their experiences helping bring children into the world. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support comes from Bodywork Associates, offering professional, licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Two locations, including inside the Activities and Recreation Center, north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus, and on Windsor Road in Champaign. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Now it's time for Faith Matters. That's the part of the program where we talk about faith, religion, and spirituality. Over the past few weeks, we've talked a number of times about the hundreds of girls who were kidnapped from a school in northern Nigeria. Now, at first, it wasn't clear who was responsible, although all signs pointed to the extremist group Boko Haram. When leaders of that group finally did claim responsibility, they also said they abducted the girls in the name of Islam. But Muslims around the world are condemning the kidnapping, and they say the group has a distorted and disturbed look at what the religion really says about such behavior. One of the people who felt compelled to speak out about this is our very own Arsalan Iftikhar, one of our barbershop regulars. He is senior editor at the Islamic Monthly, an adjunct professor of religious studies at DePaul University, and he wrote an opinion piece for CNN this week titled, Hey Boko Haram, Pick Up a Quran and Bring Back Our Girls. Arsalan, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Always good to be with you, Michelle.
Arsalan, you cite specific quotes from the Muslim holy book, the Quran, that specifically oppose what Boko Haram has done. Can you share some of those with us?
Sure, Michelle, and I only quoted a few of the verses from the Quran which would repudiate everything that Boko Haram has done. But in my CNN column, you know, one of the penultimate verses of the Quran that I quote is chapter 2, verse 191, which says that oppression is worse than murder, and also chapter 24, verse 33, which forbids anybody to force girls into any sort of prostitution. What I wasn't able to quote were other passages of the Quran, for example, chapter 4, verse 20, which says that it's not lawful to make women marry people outside of their own volition against their will, nor should you detain them, which is in direct repudiation to Boko Haram. And I could go on for hours quoting chapter and verse of things that Boko Haram has done that are completely forbidden in Islam.
I'm not asking you to speak for them, but they seem to have a strong belief that they are purifying the faith. In fact, the name is loosely translated to mean that Western education is forbidden or is sin. Where are they getting that idea from?
I don't know where they're getting that idea from. You know, education has always been a central part of Islamic teachings. The Prophet Muhammad said in many times in his life, especially in his final sermon, that, you know, you need to treat your women well, and that, you know, his wife, Aisha, after the death of the Prophet Muhammad, actually became one of the leading Islamic jurists and Islamic scholars in the world. And so, you know, Muslim women have an equal right to get education, just like Muslim men do and people of all faiths do. And education is something that has always been highlighted in Islamic tradition when the Prophet said that, you know, go attain education, even if you have to go as far away as China. And so education is something that has always been a central part of the Muslim faith.
And, you know, I wanted to ask you about your decision to speak out about this. You know, among people actually around the world who are of the Muslim faith, who are public commentators, who are speaking about this. I'm wondering if that's a tricky decision for you because, you know, on the one hand, I think reasonable people would argue that you know, should the many be condemned for the acts of a few? You know, but yet many people obviously feel that they must write these op-eds and denounce this behavior and say that this is un-Islamic. I wanted to ask, why do you feel that you felt called upon to do this?
You know, that's a very good question, Michelle. And, you know, you're right, it is a slippery slope. On the one hand, you don't want to honor Boko Haram by, you know, addressing their grievances, but... You know, for Muslims, sadly, you know, there's no religious minority demographic group, at least here in the United States and in the West, that is more prone to collective guilt than Islam and Muslims. And so if Muslim public intellectuals like myself do not speak out against atrocious acts like what Boko Haram did, then people will criticize that Muslims aren't condemning this. And then when we do condemn it, then people say, well, not enough Muslims are condemning it. And so, you know, it's one of those double-edged swords. We do it out of a sense of morality. We do it out of a sense of, you know, our Islamic duty to speak out against injustice, regardless of where it occurs and regardless of the nature of the perpetrators.
Is there an analogy you would wish to draw from Boko Haram to others? Because there are other people who will say that, yes, they are claiming this in the name of Islam. They are claiming this as part of their tradition. And they are claiming that, in fact, that they have a purer form of understanding of the religion than you, that the others who disagree with them are, in fact, kind of corrupt and that they're trying to kind of purify the faith. Is there an analogy that you might draw that would illuminate this for people who kind of see it that way?
You know, the analogy that I always give, Michelle, in a lot of my media appearances is that extremists like Boko Haram are about as Muslim as the Westboro Baptist Church is Christian. You know, just because you have some sort of religious moniker in your name, you look at the Lord's Resistance Army, for example, with Joseph Kony and the Kony 2012 campaign. If you look at the Lord's Resistance Army and their ideology, they have a Christianist worldview as well. And I think that all Christians would say that, you know, getting child slaves as soldiers would be completely antithetical to any Christian teachings. And, you know, I always tell people that if a person of any religion says that God is speaking to them, they probably need a checkup from the neck up and not be taken seriously.
So you're saying that this is a dystopic cult. This is essentially a cult and
Correct.
That they don't speak for
they're not even close to speaking. They're in the fringe lunatic, like any religion with over a billion adherents have. And that's why, like I said, Muslim thinkers and writers like myself need to continue to speak out to help educate people who might not know anything about Islam or Muslims and might somehow think that sex slavery and human trafficking would be condoned by any world religion today.
Are you hoping that clergy, this is the day of worship for Muslims, are you hoping that this will be spoken about in mosques around the world? And if so, what would you hope that people would say as briefly as you can?
Well, I think that, the Muslim zeitgeist has spoken out against Boko Haram. You had the Iranian foreign ministry condemning the acts, the Egyptian religious ministry condemning the acts, the largest newspaper editorial boards in Pakistan and Indonesia, two of the largest Muslim countries on earth. This is one of those, global events that has, again, tarnished the image of Islam and Muslims. And this is something that we Muslims are going to continue to speak out about, both in our pulpits, in our mosques, and in the public marketplace of ideas like here.
That's Arsalan Iftikhar. He is senior editor at the Islamic Monthly and adjunct professor of religious studies at DePaul University. We'll miss you in the barbershop today, Arsalan, but thank you so much for joining us for this important discussion.
My pleasure, Michelle. Thank you.
Mother's Day is coming up, and as we look ahead to that, let's take a moment to think about how millions of us came into the world. That is to say, with the help of midwives, the women and sometimes the men who help women through the birthing process. In many places, midwives are the only assistance expectant mothers receive, and now there may be a global midwife shortage. A 2011 report by Save the Children warned that a lack of midwives in the developing world meant that tens of thousands of women and babies were at risk of dying in childbirth. Today, we want to hear two perspectives on this ancient profession. Esther Madudu is a midwife from Uganda. She is the face of the global campaign Stand Up for African Mothers. It is an effort from AMREF, a health organization that aims to train 15,000 African midwives by 2015. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
And for additional perspective, we also have with us Ebony Roebuck. She's a certified nurse midwife based right here in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
We wanted to hear more about their work and how it can differ on different continents. So, Ebony, I'm going to start with you because midwives used to play the same kind of role in the birthing process in the U.S. that they played, elsewhere in the world, but they don't seem to be as central to the process now, mm-hmm. In the U.S. They are still the choice of many mothers who are very passionate about it. I wanted to ask if you could describe for people who aren't familiar with your practice, what role you play? Are you the primary sort of birth coach? What do you do?
Yeah, so midwifery now, I know some people always kind of think that I'm a secret undercover circus or animal trainer, but we take care of women throughout the lifespan. We do GYN care, we do OB, prenatal, we deliver, we also do postpartum, and we also take care of women all the way through menopause. So a typical office, I see everything from contraception to an annual to prenatal visit.
And what's a typical day for you, very briefly?
So a typical day, if I'm in the office, I see maybe like 15 to 20 patients. Or if I'm on the labor floor, I am taking care of women in labor and trying to catch babies.
Okay. Oh, so Esther, what about you? Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, it is familiar because midwife is a midwife. We do the same things. But, midwifery in Africa is something very different from the U.S. because one midwife has a 24-hour commitment. Mothers come to her at any time.
You know that AMREF is actually campaigning for your nomination for next year's Nobel Peace Prize to recognize the work of midwives who work in challenging circumstances. But I did want to ask for people who are not familiar about some of the challenges that perhaps are invisible to people who don't do the work that you do.
The challenges I face mostly is, you can imagine a mother walking 720 kilometers to the health facility, maybe with bleeding, that mother can die. And that trauma comes to the midwife. You feel it that I wish I was there. I wish this mother was in the health facility. And the challenge again is you want to help a mother, but you find that there's nothing you use. There's no drug to save the situation. And worst of all, or the best of all, a midwife, if she's trained, she's a small doctor in a small scale because she's available 24/7 and she's so simple, easy to approach her than us in Africa. Seeing a doctor is very expensive. And if this midwife is trained, she's able to take care of over 500 mothers per year and conduct deliveries of about 100 babies per year. And you find it's something very simple, and a woman easily walks in to approach a midwife than approaching the doctor.
What drew you to this work?
It's this a good story, because I got it from my grandmother, who happened to be a birth attendant. I was a little girl, about 6-7 years. I could see mothers who were coming to her house with big abdomen, and I was such an inquisitive girl to ask what they ate so that the abdomen would become so big and distended. So over and over, what have they eaten? So,
well, in this country, we would say a watermelon, of course.
Yeah.
Swallowed a watermelon seed.
Yeah, and one day she let me in and said, "Esther, come and see what is coming out of the big abdomen." So she was conducting a delivery. I witnessed a delivery, and I asked her, "Who taught you how to do that?" She said, "Me, I'm using my natural knowledge. For you, when you grow up, go to school." That was her caution to me, that you go to school and you'll become a nurse. So for me, I'm using my natural knowledge. So I grew up with that vision and that passion. I said, I must be that person who can help women. Mm-hmm. I must do this work. That's how I became a midwife.
Oh, well, that's amazing. Well, Ebony, what about you? How were you drawn to this work? Why did you want to be a midwife?
I actually was always fascinated with pregnancy and birth. Anybody in my family that was pregnant, I was like their little birth assistant, whether it be like errands or going to get them food. And I actually went to school to be an obstetrician, and then ended up with a psych degree because it was safer. And then met a midwife.
Meaning safer. Safe.
Well, I was probably the first in my family to go to school, and I got, I thought was horrible grades, but they really were not horrible. But I was scared, and I didn't have maybe better mentorship. And so the psych department recruited me, and so I got a psych degree. But I went for an annual, and, you know, usually when you go for an annual, you're undressed. And I walked in, and she said, "Don't take off your clothes." And, like, sat me down and did, like, a really detailed history and asked me questions nobody had ever asked me. And she was teaching me stuff about my body. And I was like, this is very different. I've never had an annual like this, you know, and I'm a grown woman. And she said, because I'm a midwife. Because a lot of people focus on midwifery just thinking that it's only related to birth. But midwifery is about women empowerment. It's about education. And our relationships with the mothers and women is a lot more intimate. And so I just fell in love. Best decision ever.
That's wonderful. If you're just joining us, we are learning more about the lives and work of two midwives, Ebony Roebuck, that's who is speaking just now, who practices in Washington, D.C., and Esther Madudu, who's with us from Uganda. Esther, we are learning, as I understand, that there is a shortage of midwives. Is part of the issue, though, I was wondering in part about the lifestyle, though. You were telling us it's a 24-hour commitment. You know, we have the same issue here, getting medical personnel in underserved areas, is that a lot of people say, I don't want to be on call 24 hours a day. And I just wonder if that's part of it.
But, you know, if you're motivated, you do your work very happily, and you can do without any complaint, you know. In my country, midwives, they are having the passion to do the work, not for money, not for anything, because they feel it, you know. Like me now, I'm here, I'm missing touching the abdomen because I love it and I like it. And you know, midwifery is hands-on, you know, hands-on. It's practice. When you miss midwifery skills for a month, you have to begin afresh.
I understand that there's an effort also to get more men interested in this field. Is this true?
Yeah.
Is that happening?
It's one of the AMREF's initiative objectives in this campaign of Stand Up African Mothers, because we are trying to involve men in reproductive health. I'm very happy to say that men now are coming up to do midwifery. And we
men
have
are involving in midwifery.
Yes. Because in most of our countries, men used to fear, you know, doing that. But now boys are coming and they're doing very well.
We researched this question, and in 2012, there were around 13,000 certified nurse midwives in the U.S., and which is a pretty small group, given how big this country is and how many women are of age to have babies. And I'm just Do you see, what do you see? I mean, is it that, why do people seek out a nurse midwife experience as opposed to, say, a doctor or some other birthing experience? And do you see a desire to grow this profession?
Definitely, definitely. Mm-hmm. I think that more women, like I said, are becoming birth consumers. They want more of a say. They want more options. They want less interventions. Because I think that birth has moved definitively towards having more interventions. And I think women are seeking out the opportunity to have more time. I think women are looking for the intimacy. I always make the joke that midwives hug their patients. And they're also another surge of women that are looking for unmedicated births. You know, we're all in this green lifestyle, organic, and you have more women looking for the opportunity to birth without medication. And we are the specialists. You know, we're not surgeons, but I can definitely labor you unmedicated. and that's its own skill set. Women just want more options. And so they're coming to us, flocking to us pretty heavily.
Well, thank you for your work. Thank you for your work.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Esther Madudu is a midwife from Northeast Uganda. She's the face of AMREF's global campaign, Stand Up for African Mothers. She was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios, along with Ebony Roebuck, who is a certified nurse midwife based here in Washington, D.C. And they're spending some time together and were nice enough to take some time out to spend with us. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, she's back. Monica Lewinsky's essay for Vanity Fair is online and will hit newsstands next week. She says it is time to bury the blue dress. We'll ask the barbershop guys if they agree and to weigh in on the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal nearly two decades later. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pajamagram Company, offering women's pajamas in gift packaging delivered overnight and for Mother's Day at pajamagram.com. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate. This is NPR.
I'm Robin Young from Mother's Day. How about creating a YouTube channel with your mom?
Did you hear Pamela Anderson just cut her hair short?
I can't even begin to imagine.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
Many biologists say that humans are causing a major global extinction, but out of the losses, there could be some gains.
As we change the environment right across the world, this produces new opportunities for new things to evolve that will be able to make use of the new environment that we're creating.
Nature's resilience and the current extinction crisis. I'm Steve Kerwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Saturday evenings at 8 on AM 580.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to experience sustainable specials and everyday indulgences at Intermezzo Cafe. More information about upcoming events is on KrannertCenter.com.
I'm
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our writer Jimmy Israel, with us from Cleveland. Neil Minkoff, a healthcare consultant and a contributor to National Review Online, joins us from Boston. From Pittsburgh, Republican strategist Lenny McAllister. He is the host of Get Right with Lenny McAllister on KDKA News Radio. Just, I love the title. Should have been mine. And in our Washington, D.C. studio, contributing editor for The Root, Corey Day. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Fellas,
what's up?
Welcome to the shop. How
what's going
doing?
On now?
What's oh, up? Oh, my God.
I know you're excited, Jimmy.
Oh, I am a little turnt up. Can you tell? You know, let's get things started because it's NFL draft season and Johnny Football. He's coming to my town. That's right. It's the Menzel principal jumping off Cleveland.
Nice.
Johnny Manziel, the former Texas A&M quarterback, will be a Cleveland Brown. Here's what he had to say about this last night. Drop that clip, please.
To be here, it feels right, and it feels like where I'm meant to be, and I'm very excited. Dog pound, here we come.
Oh, snap! Right after the pick!
It's like he hasn't had a day like this for a long time, Jimmy. Go
Can
ahead,
somebody
Jimmy.
Please celebrate. Remind well, Jimmy on. That you I'm don't not... win Super Bowls in May, you win them in February. Clevelanders forget these things. Pittsburgh
well, hold
don't,
on.
But Clevelanders
one thing we
let the man
one
have
thing,
his day.
Hold on. One thing we didn't forget was to buy tickets because the Cleveland Browns reportedly sold 200 new season tickets. You know, check this out. This is going to be like John Henry Days up in here. Hashtag Colson Whitehead. So, Lenny, there's a great player headed to our Pittsburgh Steelers. So you got some bragging to do too, bro.
Yeah, and Ryan Shazier is going to be a great linebacker for the Steelers. He's going to be chasing down Johnny Manziel whenever he gets on the field, and it'll be
whatever.
You know, another couple of seasons where the Steelers sweep the Browns. It'll be no big change, and it'll still be 20,000 Steelers fans
go.
At Cleveland Browns Stadium in the fall. It's no big deal.
And it's on.
All right,
and it's on.
Right.
And
so
and
it
did
begins.
You know, but he was good, though. He didn't slip in. One for the thumb. He didn't slip down.
Oh, we already got one for both thumbs. It's all good.
Dr. Neil.
Yeah, the thing that there are two things that I think are fascinating about this. One is that, you know, even a decade ago, 5 years ago, the NFL draft was something you read about in the paper the next morning to see what your team did. And then you went to Sports Illustrated at the end of the week to see how it kind of all sorted out. And it's just fascinating in terms of the NFL is the league that grabs technology and makes it work for them, whether it's replay or Twitter or this, which is now all of a sudden this is must-see TV. It's being tweeted. It's being tracked, followed online real time. And everybody has a stake in it when it's really it's May, right? I mean, like none of this. And it's almost impossible for one person to change the culture of a football team or to make them a winner the way it would be in the NBA draft. So I just think that the fact that this has become this giant spectacle is fascinating.
I love it. It's like Ebony Fashion Fair, only not.
I think that's some hate. You know, okay.
Corey, what about Corey? You want in?
Okay.
Anything you have to
hey,
about?
Man, you know, I'm a huge – football is my favorite sport. So, you know, it's become the hot stove league in the off season. So I'm all good with it.
Okay.
That's all.
Okay. All right, my man.
That means he didn't like his draft pick last night.
Why are you bringing up old stuff, Lenny? Come on, man.
Look, if y'all going to do it, I mean, take the gloves off. Let's get it on. But
that's
well,
nice.
Why y'all
– Elevate. Right. It's almost Mother's Day.
Elevate. Don't play or hate. Elevate.
That's
so
right.
Let's bounce from football to basketball. Shout out to Kevin Durant of the Oklahoma City Thunder.
KD.
Now, he was named most valuable player this year, but it was his speech honoring his mom that may earn him the most props. Drop that clip.
One of the best memories I had is when we moved into our first apartment. No bed, no furniture, and we just all sat in the living room and just hugged each other. Because that's what we thought we made it. You made us believe. You kept us off the street. You sacrificed for us. You're the real MVP.
That sounds a lot like the speech I got. I gave when I gave my MFA, and I got it. Anyway, before you know, I'm not gonna call a play on it. Let's just keep moving. Before dedicating the award to his mom, Durant called out his teammates individually, telling each of them how they contributed to his success. And it was a long speech, but he gets dap for a great tribute to his family and the team. That said, Dr. Neil, was he a good pick, you think?
So I do think Kevin Durant was a great pick. I love the speech, the fact that the NBA seems sometimes from the outside to be a very me league with a lot of ISO plays and a lot of tweeting and that sort of thing. And so KD making it so inclusive I thought was fantastic. But, you know, the thing about Kevin Durant is he's so good that in some ways I wonder if he falls into the trap like Kareem did once upon a time and Tim Duncan has more recently, where he's so consistently excellent that you kind of forget about him and you start watching the players who are flashier, like a LeBron, even though Kevin Durant is as good as it gets.
That's really interesting. Lenny?
He's not LeBron. He should have won the MVP. He should have won the MVP this season. LeBron James is the MVP for the decade. So, I mean, so you got to take that into consideration as well. We still don't know who's going to be the MVP of the postseason. Let's not forget the reigning MVP of the postseason is LeBron James, who, by the way, has two championship rings. What I did like about this, though, was the fact that Durant called out all of his teammates. And for somebody that was just called Mr. Unreliable, he showed a whole lot of foundation and consistency and stability with that speech. And I commend him for it.
Yeah.
Well,
absolutely.
You know, people were saying that LeBron couldn't close either. Remember that? You remember
yes,
that?
They
Does
did.
Anybody
mm-hmm.
remember that?
Yeah,
which
of
is,
course.
You know.
Oh, yeah.
Corey, what did you think?
Sounds silly now.
Well, no, he, you know, KD was the MVP. And, you know, shout out to, you know, the homie from D.C., the D.C. area. You know, my brother and I have known him since he was in high school, and the guy has never changed. He's always been humble. He's always been, he's almost like a savant. You know, this guy has been sort of all about basketball and all about sort of humility from the beginning. And he's never changed. He's always been the same person. I think what's interesting here, you know, Neil mentioned it to some degree, but also we were just talking about the NFL. The NFL markets teams. They don't market players. The NBA markets individual players, and that's where that me culture comes from. So here's KD as sort of the ultimate team guy. And so, yeah, what's interesting, though, is the reason why Tim Duncan, for example, doesn't get marketed is because he doesn't have much of a personality. Let's be honest. That dude doesn't want to talk to anybody or about anything outside of playing ball. KD is not that guy. He does have a personality. So it's a different thing there. But I think, you know, as far as his play on the court, that dude had 40 straight games of scoring 25 or more points when his star teammate, Russell Westbrook, was hurt. And when all his opponents were keying on him, they still couldn't stop him. This dude is out of control. He is the best offensive player anyone has seen in this league in the last decade.
You know what I can say? I like, obviously, you know, I'm sitting here like ready to cry when he's talking about his mom. So there's, of course, that.
Absolutely.
So thank you for giving me a minute to
Absolutely.
Get it together. But also, I loved his use of words.
Yes.
Because we often, you know.
He was eloquent.
He was eloquent. The specificity of the stories, both about his teammates and about how he grew up. I mean, his elegance in the use of language painted a very vivid picture of what sports is supposed to be about, which is a way to.
No cliches.
Create character, build character, and to rise.
Yep.
And I think that, for me, is what was so profound. When he talked about his mom getting him up to run laps. I thought that was profound. I mean, we see this out, you know, here. Like, it used to be like dad could get you up to run laps, but now it's, you know, he's mom. In a lot of households, it is mom getting you up to run laps. And I just think that the way he painted a picture of what sports can do in someone's life, I thought was really profound, and I was just really appreciative of that. So if you're just joining us, you're listening to our weekly Barbershop Roundtable. We're joined by writer Jimmy Israel, journalist Corey Dade, Republican strategist Lenny McAllister, and healthcare consultant Neil Minkoff. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Okay. Well, our next topic is Monica Lewinsky, America's favorite homewrecker or Bill Clinton victim, depending, of course, on who you ask. She wrote an essay for the latest Vanity Fair, and Lewinsky says, quote, "It's time to burn the beret and bury the blue dress."
I'm going to step out on this one because I think, as everyone here remembers, you know, my husband represented her mother in the course of all this and was a part of her legal team. So I will be stepping out on this. Just call me when you're ready for me to come back.
All right, shout out Billy while you're at it. Yeah, what's up, Billy? Yo, so it's like this. I kind of admire that she won't be held down. I admire that, you know, she's keeping a low profile, but she still has a story to tell. You know, she has a claim as probably the first real tragedy of the internet age. And, you know, I don't know what the future holds for her, but I guess as the father of a daughter who hopefully will not make mistakes like these, but is likely to make mistakes, my heart just... my God, I mean, she shouldn't have to be paying for this this mistake, this this picadillo for the rest of her days. I can't. I just can't. Lenny McAllister, what do you think was the point of this essay?
Well, the point of this essay was basically the same thing as what Barack Obama did with his drug use with a book. Let's get this out in the open right now so people can talk about it 2 years in advance so that by the time the election actually comes, this is not something that can be used against somebody anymore. The way President Obama did that years ago, this is why the Monica Lewinsky story presence is all coming back now so that no one can try to pin this to Hillary Clinton in 2016 and say this is about instability and all the craziness that will come around that if it weren't played this way. This was something that was very intentional. I think it was orchestrated with the Clintons, believe it or not, to get this out of the way, give her some highlights, show that she's moved on, show that the Clintons have moved on, and not allow 2016 to be about Bill Clinton. Let it be about Hillary Clinton, for better or for worse.
Do you have some evidence of that, may I ask? I mean, that's your theory. Do you have some evidence of that being that's the case?
That's me being a political strategist. I mean, you get these things out of the way. You try to make sure that things that people can use against you, you bring to the forefront to show that you're playing with clean hands and being honest about this. It's the same way Barack Obama did this about the drug use. And if you think about it, if that would have come out in 2008, it would have blown up his candidacy. You're talking about some pretty, you know, interesting revelations that he had. If he does it in 2008, it hurts him. He doesn't win. If he does it prior to that, he has a chance to reshape his image and go from there. This is what I think the Clintons are doing now.
All right. What do you think, Corey?
Yeah, I don't buy that for a minute. Because by that rationale, the Hillary campaign would have had her come out with this in 2008 or in 2007. So there's no reason why the Hillary Clinton camp would actually collude with Monica Lewinsky to bring this out this year, when in reality, you know, Hillary Clinton is ideally probably going to be more strongly situated to run in 2016 than she was in 2008. So I think that's, you know, that's bunk. No offense, Lenny, my man. But what's interesting to me is that, you know, 16 years have passed since this affair. We've forgiven Bill Clinton, right? But we still have not really forgiven Monica Lewinsky. You know, she was fresh out of college, an intern, and, you know, she was an intern who got taken advantage of by her boss. We can't stop blaming her for being sexual prey. I mean, that's really what we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. So before there was slut shaming, there was this. This was the precedent set for slut shaming. You know, Clinton obviously has gone on and become a statesman and icon. But Lewinsky, you know, she can't find a job. She can't advance her career. I think it's useful for the rest of us that she resurfaced now because it forces us to sort of challenge our irrational sort of collective hate for this woman. And I think that, you know, she has always been this convenient scapegoat for women with cheating husbands, especially women with cheating husbands who won't leave those husbands. And I think, you know, I think it's now time to really, you know, just confront this. You know, at this day and age, we are still, you know, blaming the quote-unquote homewrecker really as a crutch.
Hmm. Neil, what do you think?
So I was actually struck by the fact when I looked at the excerpts of the essays, and I was struck by how composed she has become. And I'm with Corey on this one. I mean, I think one of the things looking back on it it was so, you know, I look back and I think about, for example, like the Saturday Night Live skits with John Goodman playing Linda Tripp and them having the phone call late at night. Remember that? And it was all about like how she wasn't good enough for the president. And there was all of this like real negativity, not just about what they did, but who she was as a person and what she looked like, that in retrospect is just so horribly demeaning and hopefully is something that we've gotten beyond. And, you know, I don't believe that this was staged. I think I agree with Corey. It would have happened in 2007 or so. But I do think that this woman just needs some peace. And I agree with this idea that if Clinton's image has been rehabilitated, then we need to let the Lewinsky jokes go.
Let me push back on that real quick. Number one, part of the reason why Hillary didn't do it in 2007 is because nobody took Barack Obama seriously. He had a funny-sounding Muslim name and had been in the Senate for 2 years. Nobody thought he was going to win until Iowa. So
and Lenny, you know that? You know that. As someone who was covering the campaign, you know
that. At the polls in 2006 and 2007, everybody thought Hillary Clinton was going to win in 2000.
But you know specifically. No, but you know specifically, Camp Hillary decided not to actually
Are we talking about revealing sources, or are we talking about political theory when it comes to strategy? When you talk about strategy, it's the same exact thing Barack Obama did. You get your flaws out of the way, because if you let it ride in 2016, now you start talking about Hillary's stand by your man in 1992 comment, as well as the controversy around the White House, and did she have a role in it, and did she have her hands dirty in trying to cover that up at all? Because remember, he almost got impeached. You don't want all that stuff coming up in 2016. Get it out of the way now.
Okay. Well, that's your theory. We heard it. And we will see. I'm sure somebody will get to the root of that. So thank you for that. Okay. We have a minute left. And when we last talked about the Wu-Tang's upcoming album, most of you were excited. But hearing this week that they collaborated with Cher, I had to get your opinion on that. So, Corey, thumbs up or not so much?
I'll thumbs up. I heard it. I heard I heard what she, you know, their little hook that she's saying. You know, I think this is interesting. What I love about it is just the buzz, the buildup. You know, what we're going to see is, you know, more coverage of this, you know, more kind of leaks of who's collaborating and all this. And, you know, RZA has already gotten a $5 million offer for that album.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, no fool he. Yeah. All right, Jimmy, I'm going to give you the last word here.
If I could turn back time.
Right.
I mean, if you could sing.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, it was a stunt.
I wasn't hoping the last word would be that painful, but go ahead. Go ahead.
It was a stunt and it worked. There you go. That's
you like it? Word. All right.
I love Cher. I like the Wu-Tang.
All right. There it is. Jimmy Israel is a writer. You can find his blog at jimmyisrael.com. He was with us from Cleveland. Corey Date is a contributing editor for The Root and runs their political blog, The Take. He was with us in Washington, D.C. Neil Minkoff is a healthcare consultant and contributor to National Review Online, with us from Boston. From Pittsburgh, Lenny McAllister. He's a Republican strategist, host of Get Right with Lenny McAllister on KDKA News Radio. Thank you all so much.
Here we go.
Yes, sir.
Here we go.
Yes, sir.
And I'll take your Happy Mother's Day congratulations. Thank you.
Okay, Michelle.
Remember the card. Remember, if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast. That's in the iTunes store or at NPR.org. That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more on Monday.